In association with Newsarama.com, welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, Marvel writer Matt Fraction checks in with comments on his new issue of Punisher War Journal. Issue 6 came out this week, drawn by Ariella Levetti, and featured the debut of Frank Castle's new Captain America-inspired Punisher costume. We'll talk about that, plus the Immortal Iron Fist, co-written with Ed Brubaker, Casanova, Matt's Super Spy series from Image Comics, The Champions, an upcoming series from Marvel later this summer, and we'll talk about some new and old movies that have Fraction's brain buzzing. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% and more. That's right, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to MailOrderComics.com. Matt Fraction is in the midst of his first year at Marvel Comics, well into his runs on Iron Fist and Punisher War Journal. Like many Marvel books, the fallout of Civil War is playing out heavily in Punisher War Journal, including the notion that Frank Castle has picked up the mask of Captain America and will carry on the tradition as he sees it. What I really like about what you've shown in these first six issues is you've shown a real knack for merging real-world issues with a Marvel Universe sensibility.
Thank you. You know, I don't know that comics are the place. Like, I don't think I need to see Batman punch. I take it back. I do very much need to see Batman punch Osama bin Laden, but it's sort of not the way that maybe other people need to see it happen. That's definitely been a goal. Like, how do you talk about real stuff but filter it through, you know, Punisher?
Yeah, well, it's like the hate monger dealing with the border situation, or at least as an excuse to cause attention for himself.
Yeah, and you can tell sort of where I was when I was planning this arc. It was in the lead up to the last election, where, like, you know, the border stuff was really flaring up in terms of headlines and stuff. And it's just night after night of listening to, like, Lou Dobbs or whatever. It's just like, Jesus Christ, I have to shoot somebody in the face, and since I can't, Frank Castle can. But no, and it's sort of like you saw, yeah, I mean, Warren Ellis is kind of a master of it. Greg Rucka's Wolverine run, which I think kind of gets an unfair shake, but I was a big fan of it. Like,
me
Rucka
too.
Very clearly was, like, talking about stuff that pissed him off.
Yes.
But, like, doing it through Wolverine in, like, a very cool kind of way. But I mean, and even Ed's Captain America stuff, it's like, well, if we can deal with this stuff, but maybe there's a better way to do it. You know, you have to use sort of the language of the superhero comic instead of my cat just knocked over an entire cup of pens on my desk. Thank God we're not running yet, right?
That's the beauty of podcasts, man. It all goes in, so that's good.
I have a Darkseid mug from Burger King that came out in like 1986 that I keep all my pens in because I like the idea of Darkseid holding my pens.
Sure.
But anyway, so thank you. I'm glad you dug it. That was, you know, that's always a thing. I think Frank is a really great character for that too. I think, like, Punisher is a really great. It's awesome to talk about stuff that pisses you off in a very real way in a Punisher comic because, you know, you can find new ways into it that don't compromise really what you're doing and don't make, and, you know, you don't feel. The last thing you want to do is, like, cheapen any of this stuff, you know.
Well, I like the fact too that yes, it's reflective of its times. The war journal, as much as it was in the 80s and in the early
90s. Exactly. It's great to go back and reread the early, the sort of when Punisher really kind of exploded. Like, he's such a character of the 80s. Like, it's all about, like, war on drugs hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I mean? It's all like, one hit of this drug and you're addicted for life. Go get him, Frank. You know, it's like, it's crazy, super Bolivian turbo cocaine. What? But yeah, it's such an 80s comic to go back and read. It's all about the war on drugs and, you know, South Americans and their unholy drug cartels. And one of my, like, goals is, if we're going to put Frank in the Marvel Universe, let's sort of do it in a way that keeps true to the spirit of the character, where the characters come from, you know, and sort of what his roots are, what his origins are, but do it in a way that doesn't cheapen anybody's actual suffering, hopefully, you know.
I hear you. Bringing G.W. Bridge into the story.
Yes.
S.H.I.E.L.D. is all over the place in the Marvel Universe, and the great thing about it is there are so many different agents, so that you get a different perspective, and G.W. Bridge is very different from Dum Dum Duggan or Maria Hill.
Yeah. I love Bridge's just, like, single-mindedness. I love that Bridge has always been old.
Yes.
So, like, we never saw, like, a young Branch. He just wasn't. He's always been, like, 58. Like, that's awesome to me. Like, he's just this sort of lifelong ball buster. And, you know, I wanted somebody who could be, like, who would, like the Jack Bauer character, you know, the sort of relentless guy who is totally fine with crossing the occasional line if it means getting the job done, to be the one going after Frank. And I actually had suggested something else. I believe it was actually Axel that had suggested Bridge. And it was just such a great fit.
That's cool. Man, we're getting the entire Fraction Menagerie
Yeah,
tonight.
Yeah.
This
no,
is good.
It's awesome.
I like this. What kind of dog have you got?
Well, those are two dogs.
Okay.
That's the one is a lab pointer mix, and the other is a Goldie and a Chow.
Wow.
Mix.
And their names?
This is how much of an awesome husband I am.
Okay.
I found the Goldie Chow sort of wandering our neighborhood in winter, and he had, like, icicles in his fur.
Oh.
And he'd clearly been, like, sleeping outside and was hungry and scared and terrified and really gentle. I bring him in, and then, like, 3 days later, I take off on my wife for, like, 3 weeks to go to L.A. to research the champion stuff. Honey, I'm bringing in a stray. See you in a couple weeks.
What are the dogs' names?
I'm going to sweep the Husband of the Year's awards this year, I can tell.
What are the dogs' names?
Captain Applejack is the lab pointer, and my wife named the new one Claude.
And what's the cat's name?
Pablo and Ham are the cats.
Wow, man.
We had gone through a few different... I was calling Claude New Dog for a while. I really wanted New Dog to stick. But, like, it horrified the vets when we wrote to them. The vets, like, get a shot. So the vets were like, oh, what's your dog's name? Like, New Dog. And they were like, oh, you can't name a dog that. Like, the dog doesn't know.
Tell that to the dog whisperer on National Geographic.
Dude, the dog whisperer tricks totally work on this one. It's awesome.
That's cool.
It's crazy. That thing, it's fantastic.
Matt Fraction endorsing Cesar Millan.
I would give him back rubs. That guy has changed my life as a dog owner. It's so great.
All right, back to the Punisher. Everyone freaked out when they saw the picture.
Yeah, it was great.
You know, and I guess it got the response everybody was looking for. Who came up with the design of the costume?
I was all Ariel. I think I had a few, like, I was big on wanting to see, like, the skull and the star merge together. That was sort of my only note. Like, I was just like, because I didn't, the way that I thought of Frank as a soldier and as a guy, I didn't think he would just kind of go for the straight rip of the costume. I wanted to see the skull and the star kind of mixed together, the shape sort of being vaguely similar, but that was really my only note, and the rest was just kind of up to Ariel. And hell, he's the one that's got to draw it for 6 issues. He should be comfortable with it. But yeah, no, I mean, it just seemed sort of as a character, especially kind of based on what he had seen and that the Hatemonger had done, he wouldn't just put on a Captain America outfit, but if somebody was going to be using Captain America's, sort of perverting Captain America's symbols for their own a wicked agenda, then Frank would kind of try to fight semiotic fire with semiotic fire.
Will we see Frank verbalize what the death of Steve Rogers meant to him, or will it all be action? I mean, it seems in character for it to be action, or is there going to be some speech of Frank saying, you got to understand why I'm doing this?
Yeah, I don't think he's big on speeches. You know, and especially about his feelings. You know, I mean, we see him doing it. We know it's clear why he's doing it and what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never, I feel like this, I feel like that, I feel like the other. Hopefully it's all kind of the action that comes out of his character. And it's all stuff that we've been kind of working towards really since the first issue. Not so much that it's about him trying to pay tribute to hero worship, but just the fact that someone like him could have a hero, could have anyone that he would admire, and then what does it mean to lose that person to him, and then to see that person's legacy so slandered and blasphemed, really. So I think it's all kind of character stuff, and it really speaks through the action. You know, the real pisser comes when it's all sort of resolved down the road, sort of where it goes is kind of the psychic toll it takes on Frank. You know, the sort of I don't know, well, let's the less said, the better, maybe.
Okay.
Sorry. I disappear completely on my own ass here.
No, I like that. Well, was this handed to you with the assignment of doing the book in terms of this is coming up and be prepared for it?
Yes and no. What was handed to me was he's going to pick up the mask at the end of Civil War. That I knew was coming. That I knew was a part of.
Without a reason why.
Do what now?
Without knowing that Cap was dying, or I guess
no. I mean, they told me that whole no. At that point, I don't know. I mean, I knew he got arrested. I don't know if I knew that he was.
Okay.
No, I had. I don't. Yeah, and I guess I had to have known that. Yeah.
Okay.
I was just wondering. Like, for me to have these discussions, like, I had to sign, like, NDA. Like, I had to sign, like, a huge NDA and have this, you know.
Well, no, what I'm wondering, though, is did you get the assignment from the start, knowing this is what's going on in the Marvel Universe and how the Punisher fits into it, including the fact that he will be picking up Captain America's mask at the end?
It wasn't so much as how he fits into it. It's like, you know, he's picking up Captain America's mask. It'd kind of be cool if ...
Okay.
And it was just such a berserk idea that I immediately wanted to do it. I said, absolutely. They're gonna kill us. Yes, let's do it. Like the minute that image came out, it was just like I knew. And this is we're talking like a year ago.
Right.
I just knew, like, oh man, I'm gonna get to not only be a part of like this giant continuity adjusting crossover. But then this kind of complete this thing that's just going to set people on fire. It's going to be great. Yeah, fuck yeah, let's do it.
Did you have any conversations with Loeb about Fallen Son?
Is
the Punisher figuring in Fallen Son as well?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
And I mean, there's a kind of like I mean, I want really after the logistics of Civil War. There's a reason why this arc, why the Western arc. Takes place like on the Arizona-Mexico border. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. There's a reason it's just far removed.
Right. All of a sudden, we went from New York to him going, seeing what's going on, and saying, "I got to be down in Mexico and shoot this guy's face off." Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to get all this get away from any kind of you know, just sort of tell our story and have Frank kind of go through his little ordeal and kill a lot of Nazis in the process.
Outstanding. It was nice to see that the wolves are fitted with weapons.
Yeah, like a weird like brain prosthetics. I don't even know what I just thought. Yeah, sure, robot wolves. What's better than wolves? Robot wolves.
That's very exploitive film of you. I like that.
Yeah, you know, I'm a shallow, but very broad.
Well, and you know, this I thought it dovetailed well with what we usually see in Casanova as well, in terms of some of your ideas. And the extremes that you go to. Obviously, you go a little bit further in the image world. But I would also say that I'm pleased to see that this Punisher in Marvel Knights really isn't that different from the Max Punisher, other than the fact that he's wearing, you know, the Marvel Universe outfit and might run into Spider-Man or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and people like that.
There's a lot less genital torture, but yeah, no, I mean, I'm amazed we've gotten away with it. I mean, we've gotten away with it. I'm amazed that we've done... There have been as few changes as there have been. Mm-hmm. I mean, the editorial has really supported the book and are really into it, I think. And, I mean, we're presenting super-powered neo-Nazis trying to ignite a race war. And Frank is kind of the only guy that cares. You know what I mean? Like, that's the story. Like, that's... Holy crap, really? And, like, yeah, like, hate-monger, but, like, for real, you know?
Yes.
And I'm just... there's something so shocking to me about, like, seeing a swastika that when you start to see the National Front or the National Force with these like star swastikas, it's like holy crap! I don't know. It's shocking. It's shocking on some level to me visually to actually see it happening and to. I mean, it opens with a really kind of grim. It's a bleak. You know, it's grim. It's a black-hearted superhero book. That's for sure.
Are we going to see that image on any covers? Because maybe that's the key. Is you know, that's how you keep the hate groups away from you and stuff like that. It's like, don't put it on the cover. Put it in the book, but don't put it on the cover, and that way they won't know.
No,
unless they listen to podcasts.
There's some, you know, it becomes really clear that we're talking about super Nazis down the road.
Good.
And, you know, what do we, worried about offending the hate groups, oh no.
Yeah, I know you got tougher skin than that, Matt. So
surely somewhere some skinhead is going to weep because you know clearly the creators of the Punisher aren't his biggest fan.
I am offended by what you have portrayed, and actually it could be a northern person as well. So my apologies.
Yeah, you know
we got skinheads up north in Illinois too.
Yeah,
so dude,
I more racial slurs in the streets of Chicago than I ever did living in the South.
There you go, man. Exactly, you know.
But yeah, no, it's cool. It's a I hope that, I mean everything. I knew really it's kind of a blessing, too, from, like, your earliest conversations to know where you're going to be around issue six, you know?
Cool.
Where you could go. So it's been this entire year is building to this storyline, and then the events of the storyline set up the whole second year. I think I told you earlier in sort of the pre-interview chat that there's the grimmest, blackest thing I've seen, like, I've ever written is in number nine.
Cool.
And it's just like, I was so, like, yeah, man. Yeah, this is a dark ride.
One story going back, the auxiliary cop, that was terrific.
Yeah, we're going to see him again in 11. He's coming back.
That's great. I mean, and there's a great example of, I think, great one-shot storytelling and that invention of the hero not appearing until really the final act.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of, I mean, the whole, you know, he was, yeah, exactly. That's sort of, he's kind of interesting. You know, like, he's a character that creates such a presence that even if he's not on camera.
But people are talking about
him. You can watch a dozen people react to him. You know, this whole thing with the bar, I mean, he was in the book the whole time, with number four, where he was the bartender, even though you didn't know he was there. He technically is on every page, but, you know, but he's not doing his thing. It's just about the space he creates, which is kind of fun to play in.
That's cool. I also like, too, that there's a real big budget movie feeling to these issues as well.
Yeah, no, Ariel is just... And that's the thing, too, about Ariel is you can write, like, okay, the super Nazis fly on their giant rocket bikes and spew fire across the sky, and you kind of know he's going to nail it. And when I was writing about the bikes, I was imagining them like hover bikes, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I was, like 2-3 feet off the ground, and Ariel draws these, like, skyrockets, like, flying overhead, dragging people through the air as they're on fire, screaming. And you're like, oh, my God. It's like the difference between, you know, $60 million and $100 million. It's just like, ah! So, yeah, it just gets bigger and bigger. And then you start to, you know, I love writing for that guy. He's been a blast to work with. He's just doing amazing work.
How much do you guys communicate as far as verbally versus email?
The occasional email, there's a pretty profound language barrier.
Okay.
He was, you know, we met at San Diego, and he was talking about the rhino, and I thought he was saying Reno. I thought he wanted me to set a story in Reno. And I was like, Reno? It was really embarrassing, but he's delightful. I guess he's actually coming to the States, I think, in May, so I'm going to try and say hi to him while he's out here.
Very cool.
But he's tremendous. He's also, sadly, he doesn't look a thing like his drawings. I always imagined him to kind of look almost like he draws Frank, like in real life, you know? I thought he would have, like, 72-inch biceps. Sadly, he just kind of looks like a dude.
There's a real Bond, a James Bond connection, obviously, in this issue with the rebreathers.
Yeah, I couldn't help myself.
That was cool, man, and I love, too, that they really, I think he kind of captured some real Connery-esque moments of Frank, where I'm like, wow, you know, Sean Connery could have been a good Punisher.
You know, it seemed to me that if anybody would have a frame of reference for, like, rebreathers that would refer to Thunderball, it would be the Punisher. He would, you know what I mean? Like, when you would see a rebreather, Frank Castle would think, oh, yeah, like Thunderball.
Sure. So,
I don't know. Thank you. I knew you would like that one.
Did you ever read those Mac Bolan Executioner books by Don Pendleton?
I haven't, and I kind of should. But then once I started rolling, I was worried about, like, just polluting the waters. You know.
I understand.
I think when I'm like I read it like I actually like when I wrote Five Fists, I kind of stopped reading Twain books just because I didn't want to psych myself out. And I waited until I was done with Five Fists, and I went back and kind of got caught up. So
I see.
I think when I'm done with Punisher, I'll go back and read the Bolan stuff. And I got, like, a list, kind of a little somewhere of stuff I want to check out that are sort of Punisher-esque characters. And
that's cool. For mainstream fans, Five Fists is Five Fists of Science, which was a great, if I may, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen sort of story where you had real people as opposed to 1800s fictional characters,
right.
Mark Twain being one of the – and Tesla.
And Nikola Tesla.
Nikola Tesla. And the two heroes of the book.
A lot of real events.
Yes, and a really great book, and you should definitely check it out from Image if you haven't already.
Available from Image Comics.
And Matt and I discussed it in our first interview.
Which you can download it now.
Wordbaloo.com. There you go. You see, we can cross-promote each other. This is
there
nice.
You go.
Let's move on to Iron Fist.
Okay.
And man, I'm really enjoying it, and I think you and Brubaker are like-minded guys, and I think we've kind of seen that in the past in terms of the times that you've either been interviewed by each other or referred to each other, and it's nice to see that we're getting a good book from two great writers.
Thank you very much. It's a ridiculous fun to write. And I love working with Ed, so it's a blast. And there's so many people working on it between me and Ed, and David Aja, our regular artist, and then our kind of rotating array of guest artists, as spearheaded by Travel Form every month, and then colored by the genius Matt Hollingsworth. Every issue that comes out, I love going back through and reading cover to cover, just because it's there's so many other hands on it. It really feels like I'm a small part of a much bigger team.
We also saw earlier a great addition, and one of my favorite guys that I think is overlooked a lot when you talk about great artists of the late Golden Age and early Silver Age, and that's John Severn.
Yes, absolutely, without a doubt.
And unfortunately, I hear you didn't get to write his part.
Yeah, no, Ed actually shoved me out of the way. I was I was so clearly like the only time Ed has ever pulled rank. Sort of like, I'm writing for Severn. Okay, great. Ed loud and clear called dibs on that. So, but I got to write for Russ Heath the next issue, so I ain't crying in my milk or anything.
Wow, I had no idea Russ Heath was coming up. That's fantastic.
Russ Heath in 3, and
outstanding, man. Because I love Orson Randall.
Thank you.
He's a great character and evokes kind of that great pulp quality of those great Street and Smith characters like The Avenger.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, I named him Orson, Orson Welles, as the voice of the Shadow, kind of. That's where that came from. That's why they named Orson.
So. Very cool. I love that.
That is very, we actually referred to him in the early notes as the Golden Age Iron Fist, so.
Well, there you go, and I'd like to see it. I hope that's something that's in the back of your guys' minds or future plans.
I hope so. I think we've come up with this kind of. I don't know. Yeah, hopefully, everybody's on that team, so we're trying our best to make it happen.
Very cool. And this whole idea of, I guess, really from the start, originally there was the notion that Danny Rand wasn't the first Iron Fist and that he was assuming this mantle, but we never really went back and took a look at this before.
Yeah, there was, that's the whole thing. Like, the whole seed of the book was Ed's, where he remembered some issue where Lee Kung the Thunderer showed Danny the costume in a glass case.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed, as a kid, was like, oh my God, there were others? And yeah, I mean, they've referred to others, but we've never really got a chance to meet them. So it's a great opportunity to kind of expand the myth and see all these kind of different characters from all these different eras. Speaking of which, Wu Shi, the Pirate Queen Iron Fist, the Pirate Queen of Qinghai Bay, is the first. Is going to get a solo issue in number 7.
Cool.
Is going to be an all flashback issue to her times as the Pirate Queen of Qinghai Bay.
Man, maybe in future annuals or something like that, we could get like Tales of the Iron Fist.
I think one of the things we want to do is give ourselves these kind of one-shot issues where we don't have to do these kind of big storylines. We can take breaks and just do these fun little, like the Wuoxi issue is. Do you remember Jade Men comics?
No.
They were like Chinese comics that like Mike Barron did the transliterations for.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day, like 87, 88. They're these kind of crazy, crazy Chinese kung fu comics. But it's, the Iron Fist 7 is totally like the Jade Men Princess Bride or something. It's a sort of love story told through the lens of an insane Chinese martial arts comic.
This really dovetails into, I think, the pop culture, and forgive me, zeitgeist, that produces things.
For zeitgeist?
Yes, because what an asshole I am to even say that, but there it is. but as far as producing things like Grindhouse right now, the film that Tarantino and Rodriguez did, because who would have thought a Chopsocky book like Iron Fist would work today?
Yeah, it's I've said it before and I'll say it again. Kung Fu Billionaire is a great idea for a comic book. It's not rocket science, people. Kung Fu Billionaire, sold.
See, and that's why I'm an asshole. I say pop culture zeitgeist, and you're Kung Fu Billionaire.
I got chunks of art school in my stool bigger than your pretension. Your biggest pretension on your biggest pretension day. I was busting semiotics earlier, so no apologies here.
Now, and I know you want to stay away and you want to stay pure to write new stuff, but How much did you go? Did you go back at all and read any of the cool black and white stuff, or even you know some of the great stuff that came out even in the Essential book that they just released?
With this stuff, yeah, because it's such a there's so much. The styles are so wildly different.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like I didn't with that stuff. It was the homework was a joy, and it was that kind of insane 70s storytelling where you had writers who were very clearly getting high or trying to write like they got high. And just writing, trying to do these berserk, like, Enter the Dragon cash-ins, you know, and not really pulling it off. So now with that, it's a different thing. Like, I just knew that the style was going to be different, and I don't want to sound like I'm being disrespectful of the work, but I wasn't sweating that. I didn't think that stuff was going to glom onto what we were trying to do. You know, so the research was a joy and helped a lot. And then it just kind of helps to refamiliarize yourself with it all. Because it's not like Spider-Man. The origin doesn't get retold every 6 weeks, you know?
You bet.
So.
Are we going to see more evidence? Because there really is a large martial arts family in the Marvel Universe. And they've only briefly been mentioned in any recent books. I mean, we know there's a new White Tiger, but I think of the Sons of the Tiger.
Yeah,
that ridiculously exploitive, you know, trio from the Black and White magazines.
Yeah, the Rainbow Karate Coalition. I wanted here's the thing. There's the whole thing with the amulet and the White Tiger. I'm not quite sure where the Sons fit in. I tried to be really clever and sneak them into the first issue, and it sort of got like nuts. No, that's ridiculous. I sort of got smacked for it. They're hiding. They were in the first draft. They were hiding in the first issue, and then upon a rewrite, it was no, you asshole. They can't be there.
Damn.
But there's a. If you notice the ethnicities of Mr. Zhao's bodyguards, I wanted them to be these kind of brainwashed bad guys, but they ended up not playing. So the Sons I can't speak to right now, but we get to see the kind of classic, some of the classic heroes for hire characters sooner rather than later.
Sure.
And, it's too deliciously zesty a well to not go back to somewhat. So
that's cool. Well, and you know, I obviously there is the connection with Heroes for Hire and Daughters of the Dragon and everything. So I would imagine eventually they are going to kind of creep their way back into Danny's life.
And Zeb's first issue was out. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I can't wait to check it out. I've got it sitting here. I'm so behind on everything that I haven't read. You know, how does Civil War end? I kid. And Zeb, be sure to check out the Zeb Wells Heroes for Hire book, because I'm sure there's a very special, inspired lunacy going on there. If it's Zeb Wells, it's got to be crazy.
Well, he's not only his Marvel books, but his fine YouTube movies as well.
Yeah, does he do YouTube movies?
Have you not seen Professor Xavier's birthday party?
I guess not, no.
Oh, dude, you'll love that.
Wow.
So I know other Marvel readers have probably checked that out, but there's some free kids. Check out Professor Xavier's party. It's a pool party.
No.
It's very funny.
Very cool.
We should mention Steel Serpent because he makes his appearance.
He's back, and he's all new, all different, and yet the same. That was cool. It was. I love him. He's such a weird character. He's just such a classic Marvel bad guy too. You know what I mean? He's just so bent. I'm so glad he's back, and he's really dangerous. He's not just back. I mean, we really want to make him. Make him a big badass again. Make him somebody like, ooh, you know.
Very cool.
So he's, I wrote a scene with him tonight that's completely off the chain, I think. And I'm like, wow, I may have gone too far here. So but I love writing him. He's just so deliciously, woo-ha, you know.
Will things settle into a monthly schedule, or are we going to stay on a bi-monthly or six-week schedule for the book?
We're pretty going to be okay-ish.
Okay.
The thing with Civil War being late, we kind of lost some time in pre-production.
Okay.
So we got accelerated, and then suddenly it was really just going to be a mini, and then it became an ongoing, and so we've been kind of running to get caught up. But we're doing good. And I know that there was like a little bit of a gap, but I know that with the director's cut, and we're you know looking at some other stuff. But no, we're getting caught up. We're where we need to be.
Very cool.
And part of it's just like the sheer logistics is a bit of a nightmare. I mean, there's anywhere from three to seven separate artists on any given issue, so it's not the easiest book in the world. I would like to tip my hat to the Sensual Warren Simons, our fantastic editor, for keeping the trains running as smoothly as he keeps them running.
Yeah, that is a lot of guys to juggle and everything and make sure they're doing their jobs.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and, you know, you and Ed are friends, so it's pretty easy, I would imagine. How often are you guys talking?
No, he doesn't take my calls anymore ever since he was Mr. I'm on CNN, I'm on NPR. He doesn't, I don't know.
Nice knowing you, Ed.
Yeah, I got to call his wife and be like, how's that doing? Is he okay? Can he get me in? Can he get me in to see the big man? No. We talk as often as we need, as we can, and there's always the Xbox Story Conference. People laugh, but it works. The proof is in the pudding.
That's very funny.
The world's first comic written via Xbox Live.
And Bendis tells me that he enjoys still blowing your head up. And
yeah, he talks a lot of shit, but my chainsaw gun is stickier than his most nights. he's like preternaturally good as like Brian Reed.
Really?
Yeah,
of course he is.
Well, he comes from a game culture.
Exactly. Now you're in my arena, pal.
I mean, dude,
you're in my sandbox.
We were playing in like Reed's, like calling some friends. We were playing Gears of War.
Okay.
And these buddies of Reed's that show up are actually the fucking level designers. Let me tell you what's not fun. It's your second night playing Gears of War and you're playing the level designer.
That's like Boris Spassky showed up in Washington Park. Yeah, okay, let's go.
Exactly.
Checkmate.
Great. Really?
I just sat down.
Oh, no, it's a lot of fun for me. Great.
Casanova's Future. Please tell me. When is it?
August. But we're back in August.
Okay. And the trade is
back in July, but I forgot to ask when July shit was due. It's on me. I fucked up. And I asked the day after. It had to be in, and it was July, so everybody was jamming for San Diego placement, and we just didn't make it. So we should have lots of goodies for San Diego, and then we're going to be on the stands in August. Casanova number 8 is being drawn as we speak, and it is. I'm so excited! I can't wait to get like the Casanova energy back out there into the world.
That's cool. Is the trade out?
The trade is out later this spring.
Okay, great.
And I'll have some kind of cool news about that on my website, too, if you keep your eyes peeled. I'm not sure when or what I can say, but we have cool stuff coming with regards to the collection.
Excellent.
But, yeah, Cast 8, Volume 2, new storyline, perfect jumping on point. And, yeah, it's good. The story that's either going to make or end my career.
Well, and, for mainstream people who haven't had a chance to try out Casanova, Can you give them the dime store tour?
Sure. It's about a man of leisure who is kind of on the shady side of good and evil, or at least lawful and illegal. His father is the majordomo of Empire, which is a sort of international, interdimensional law enforcement agency, and his he has a twin sister who is daddy's little girl and is sort of the Empire star agent. And he's very much a hedonist, kind of living his own sort of sleazy pleasure-to-pleasure kind of life. And this is how when we first meet him. Throughout the course of the first issue, he's abducted through space and time to a parallel dimension where the roles were switched, where the sister was the bad one and he was the good one. And in this parallel dimension, his counterpart is dead, and he is snatched through space and time to replace his own good duplicate as a double agent by Empire's arch-rival's Waste. So he is a kind of he's pretending to be a good guy for bad guys and betray his father and everything his father holds dear. So that's the kind of the conundrum we leave. That's sort of the first arc is about him being this sort of triple agent, and then the second arc is about to start up, and it's a perfect jumping on point for new readers. It really is, and I'm not just saying that.
Okay.
Obviously, you'll know that these people know each other, but it's a great place to get started.
I loved the first arc. I thought it was excellent. I enjoyed the text pieces as much as I did the story itself. And again, much like Fell, Warren Ellis's Image book, it is amazing what you guys can pack in to 14 pages?
16.
16 is even better.
Yeah. It's we're saving. Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you very much. It's always the goal. It's $2, so you don't want anybody to feel ripped off. you know? It's,
no, and they get a very complete issue each month, and then they also, or when it comes out, and then and also, again, the text pieces, which is really a look inside your mind, Matt.
Indeed.
Which is a scary tour.
It is. There's, you know, the second volume is, you know, the first issue, the first storyline where all these, every issue was its own mission. The second volume is one long mission. So it's a little more, it's a different kind of structure. There's a different format to figure out.
Okay.
I can't wait for it to drop. I can't wait for it to be out into the world and no longer just living in my head, because I'm very excited about it. I'm very happy with it.
You have a new Marvel book coming up. It's The Champions. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, Champions launches in July.
Let's talk about Champions.
Please, let's do.
What can you tell us? Nothing.
It's me doing superheroes, sort of like unabashed, like not, like, no, there's capes and stuff, and like guys with like supervision, you know what I mean? Like it's awesome. I'm really having a good time with it. And Barry Kitson, the amazing Barry Kitson, is drawing it. And he's left DC and now he's at Marvel. And this
yes.
is the book that he's sort of cutting his Marvel teeth on, popping his Marvel cherry on, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an amazing talent. And I'm writing this. I've always loved this stuff, and I've always respected this stuff, and I've never understood why he wasn't huge. You know, so I'm just trying to write the ultimate Barry Kitson book. You know what I mean?
That's cool.
And just play to all of his strengths and create this kind of new thing to talk. This sort of new, the kind of just the book is they're California in the 50 state initiative. So
mm-hmm.
they're different than the initiative. They don't, it's not tied to that or any of that stuff. But it's sort of this new superhero team that was created specifically to defend California. And the book is about their first year in existence.
And
it's a competitive entry and competitive continuance, so guys screw up and get fired or people quit and, you know, people are replaced, and it's a look at a really dynamic workplace environment.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So we haven't seen all the characters.
No, these are all new, with the exception of Tony Stark, and I mean Tony Stark, not Iron Man, but Tony Stark, and Pepper Potts. It's all new people.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good. I'm a big Pepper fan.
Yeah, she's stepping up and kind of, she's sort of the boss. She's Stark's Girl Friday and the really the functional leader of the team.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Which is kind of great to kind of see her sort of where her arc has gone this past year, and to take her into a book. Like I really respond to strong women characters like her, and I'm looking forward to writing her. Having been in the shadow of superheroes her whole life, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Sort of now, kind of pulling some strings and running the show.
That's cool. Yeah, I was glad to see the Knopf brothers bring her back as strongly as they did.
Yeah.
Only to see poor is Happy dead? Did Happy die on that hospital thing? I mean, did you know in the Knopf brothers Iron Man?
I don't know what's come out.
Okay.
I don't want to blow anything.
Never mind. well, then I'll go a different track. Are these all brand new characters as far as the heroes? We've never seen any of these guys before.
No, they're all brand new, cut from whole cloth, new powers, new people, the whole nine. No,
wow.
No tie, no connection to the old champions, no tie or connection to any other Marvel characters. It's a really kind of wild experiment, and I'm really flattered that Marvel believed in the pitch and believed in me and Barry enough to give us the opportunity to tell our story.
That's really cool. So Iron Man is the Tony Stark, as you said.
Yeah,
he's the
very,
to the Marvel
very
universe.
Cognizant about letting them, he doesn't want them to be, you know, Iron Man's buddies, you know, so he's very, very cognizant about letting them run the show. But yeah, I thought it was going to, when I started like writing the first issue, I thought it was going to be, you know, a big like reaction to widescreen comics. And I mean, there's definitely a big action set pieces and me kind of doing the big crazy stuff. Like, and if you're reading Iron Fist and Punisher, you don't know what you're in store for, a little bit. But as I started to write it, it really became a workplace piece. It became a kind of ensemble sort of West Wing. It's sort of like a superhero book as the West Wing.
Okay.
Where it's sort of about the mechanics of what keeps these teams running and what keeps these people together.
Yeah, the bureaucracy of...
There's a lot of that, yeah, and a lot of just the interpersonal dynamics. So that's the thing, is like when you can be fired for blowing it, or if you oversleep, you know what I mean? Like it's and when you're training side by side with the guy who's going to replace you, It's a different dynamic than just being on a team where, like, oh, well, I'm Batman, and I'm the only Batman on the whole Justice League. It's like if Batman had to share quarters with two other guys who were backup Batman, you know, it's going to put you in a different place.
Wow.
It's a highly competitive environment.
Oh, and there will be competition for a superhero identity?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a lot like it's a superhero team that's being run like a baseball team, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's different third basemen. There's not all in the starting lineup. And the starting lineup, you know, does not make it all the way through shit the first issue, you know?
That's cool.
And it's shifting, immutable. It's very allegiances get formed and personal, you know, vendettas and you know, it's in a weird way. You know, I went to art school, and it was a competitive continuance art school where it was state-funded, so they didn't need tuition. So you had to kind of bring it, or they'd kick you out.
Wow.
And so to me, kind of, I realized the other day, I'm sort of writing about art school. Sort of like, you know, we had these critiques, and they were vicious. You know, it wasn't a good critique unless you brought somebody to tears.
Wow.
It got them to leave the room, you know what I mean, and tore somebody apart. And it was this, so it's a sort of very high-pressure thing. And at the same time, they're superheroes, so they have to deal with all the big set-piece superhero-ass stuff and try not to kill each other.
Well, this really does value, you know, it's interesting to hear the pitch now because you hear the name The Champions, obviously you think of the old team, but then you're told they're new characters, and on one level you might roll your eyes and go, oh, God, okay, find more superheroes. That's exactly what the Marvel Universe absolutely needs. But it's nice to hear this kind of fresh perspective, and also that it dovetails out of what happened in Civil War, and it really does validate that, no, this... The Marvel Universe is a different place.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
That's really cool.
And say what you will about Civil War. I mean, they set out to change the status quo, and it has changed. You know, not a dream, not a hoax.
Yes, exactly. Not an imaginary story. Yes.
No one can, you know, yeah, no one's punching through anything. You know, like the toothpaste is out of the tube, and shit's different. The toys are broken, and they're not coming back. You know what I mean? Like, they're getting put together in really different ways. Like the Marvel U is going to have scars and stitches for a long time. And this is part of that. This is, you know, like what, the Champions are sort of near and dear to Tony's heart for, reasons that are kind of become clear in the first issue. I don't really want to blow it, but, you know, they're being run differently, but it's the thing that all the characters have in common is that they've all experienced, greatness. They've all been heroes, for lack of a better word, in a real-world sense, in their lives. They've all experienced these kind of the sacrifice and bravery that a hero really, you know, that we ask of heroes.
That
a hero really is. And some of them are in very big ways, and some of them are very small ways, and some of them have had sort of bad luck happen to them since. And you know, but it's kind of giving these people a chance to. You know, the tagline of the book is, "If you had a year to save the world, could you do it?" And that's sort of it. And everybody knows, like, well, we've got a year to make this work. Let's see what happens if we try to save the world.
Well, dude, you're all about, like, cool retro pop culture, and I'm always happy to talk to you because I'm in the same way, and it's fun because I think there's enough years between us that I'm always excited about the shit that you like because that's the shit I was watching when I was a real little kid.
Right, right.
And you're finding it now,
I'm
too.
I'm discovering it, like, hoorah!
Yeah, which is great, though, because I'm rediscovering it, and that's the wonderful thing. DVDs, much like VHS, they're just flooding the market with this stuff.
Yeah, and I don't know who I got to blow to get a Man from U.N.C.L.E. season out, but yeah.
You were telling me off the air, you just got something really cool, and it's a collection of trailers?
Oh, yeah, it's 42nd Street Forever, Volume 1. It's all these kind of exploitation trailers. I think there's actually three volumes.
Oh, my God.
The third one is the all-porno edition, and then one and two are just sort of standard exploitation, you know, poor, pretty Eddie and things like that.
You never saw Fred the Hammer Williamson like you see him in Black Caesar.
Wow, that's a great, you have great trailer voice, man.
I'm in radio, dude.
It shows. It really shows.
I always wanted to do a black exploitation version of Star Trek with just all the Uhura, Tuvok. You know, Geordi LaForge, get together for Black Trek.
Right.
And it's like, I think it's a great missed opportunity that Roddenberry never really, like, went for.
You know, and it's weird. He was into, Uhura, you know, bumped uglies.
Yes, they did.
There's no polite way to say it.
He had Nurse Chapel in Uhura, that's right.
There was really nobody. That guy was Kirk, dude. There was nobody on that show he didn't bang.
Let's put the ladies in the shortest skirts possible. Will they censor mind if the skirt ends right at the bottom of their ass?
Yeah, I know, right?
Make no.
It, Make her green. Make her green.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ensign. Can you pick that up for me, please?
Oh,
yes, you can.
But those, man,
like Benny Hill, man.
Those came out, you know, on DVD not long ago, and I picked them up. And they really terrify me.
You
know, why? You know, because they're so cheap, but they're not like, it's not like Ed Wood cheap. They're cheap enough to like, they're like Red Lobster. You know what I mean? Like it's like grandma dinner expensive. You know the Uncanny Valley theory in robotic design?
No, please.
It gauges a person's emotional response to the design of a robot.
Okay.
And what they've discovered is there is it's a rising scale left to right where the least human it looks, the less human it looks, the less empathetic you are towards it.
Okay.
So, you know, a Detroit robot, you know, a Detroit car building robot, you know, a freaking ATM machine or whatever. You know what I mean? You have
right.
no emotional response to that.
Right.
And then as you get closer to a thing that takes on human characteristics, you begin to care about it more.
That makes sense.
But there's a thing. When you get to, like 75 to 85%, there is a drop below the scale where the reaction becomes that of horror on the part of the viewer because it's disconcerting that things look almost human but are still visibly fucked up. So, like, you know how...
give me the episode.
You remember that? Well, all of them is the thing. But, like, you remember, what was the Tom Hanks stop-motion movie? The Polar Express.
Okay, yes,
remember
yes.
how people were creeped out by that?
Yes.
Because it was like more human than human. You know what I mean? It was
yes.
almost human.
Well, like Final Fantasy, too.
Same thing. There's a disconnect that comes in design when robots look like fake humans and not like actual humans where you have revulsion. I find that I have a special effects reaction, too, where there's a part where there's almost big budget, with almost not cutting corners, where when stuff is not cheap, cheap doesn't bother me. I like cheap. But when things are just sort of like, oh, look, they spent like $80 on that
yeah.
instead of $120. Like, and Star Trek is perfectly it. Star Trek, something about classic Trek just looks fake enough where it looks like they're really trying to pretend these things are... It creeps me out. I can't explain it, but it gives me unrest. I don't know how... classic Trek makes me feel tense and uneasy.
Have you seen these remastered episodes where they've kind of, you know, amped up the space scenes to make them look a little cooler? And...
No, because that's the charm. Like, that's the thing. Like, I want to... Like, I need to see the strings. You know what I mean? Like, I need to see
the collapsing cutaway video box as the shuttle pulls away from the scene. And you literally, in the older prints, you can kind of see that it's black. There's a black base, and then there's kind of this off-black base square that keeps getting smaller and smaller as the shuttlecraft pulls away.
Exactly. Well, you know, we'll go back and watch, the old VHS tapes of Star Wars. Hell, I've got the Laserdisc, the monolith Laserdisc set. Mm-hmm. You can still see the mats cut around the TIE fighters.
Oh, that's...
You know, I like it when you can see wood screws in outer space.
Sure.
You know? And there's something about the classic Trek that creeps me out. I loved watching them. It was just like, I'm so freaked out.
Well, what else? What else have you bought? I mean, we're going to get to Grindhouse because obviously I think that's the movie that's on everybody's minds right now when we talk about films like this.
Yeah.
But I want to know some more original, real stuff that you got because usually I remember we talked and you got this great Lee Van Cleef Italian Western.
Oh right. Swordsman and the Stranger or something like that. The Blood Money.
Blood. Okay.
It has like nine titles. The Gunman and the. Yeah, and we just, that was a Casanova 5 or 6.
Casanova oh, yeah, 6. That's right, Blood Money, yes.
I just part and, because the thing is the movie kind of sucked, so I just like part and parcel. Like, the whole thing is like a guy's uncle dies and he's tattooed a treasure map on various different body parts of four whores. So his Shaolin son has to travel to Texas and hook up with Lee Van Cleef to find these four Texas whores and put their asses together to find a treasure. Now, it sounds like the greatest movie ever made. I know what you've just heard me say.
Yes.
It's kind
that's
of a
great
bummer.
Pitch. Oh, that's too bad.
It's kind of like, really? And that sucks. Like, man, even at 88 minutes, you feel the length. Shit. So, no, I just was fucking just stole that like a stealer in a stealing convention. I don't know.
Have you seen Alphaville?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, God, yes.
Of course. Attaboy.
I love Alphaville.
That's cool. Are there any, you know, when we talk about Bond and spy movies and stuff, are there any, you know, knockoff? You know, what I discovered, and it was on Trio before they canceled it, were these bad Richard Johnson kind of Bond-esque movies about Bulldog Drummond, and it was Tarantino hosting them. Deadlier Than the Mail.
Yeah, Deadlier Than the Mail I've got, and the other one is, She Rhymes with Death or something like that. What's the other one?
Yeah, I can't remember now either.
This is going to drive me crazy. Some girls do.
There you go. I believe you're right. And they're the Bulldog Drummond movies for people who don't want to know what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. Deadlier Than the Mail is really mean.
Yes.
And sleazy.
Yes. Pretty for a 60s movie, absolutely.
Like, it's really, like, that's, you talk about misogyny. My God. I mean, it's like these movies, like Deadlier Than the Mail makes, like, in, like, Flint look like children of a lesser god.
For its reverence for women.
Yeah, exactly. For its respect. It's so, like, I picked it up, like, oh, my God, and Britt Eklund is in it, and it's really, you know, hot and awesome and strange and weird. And then you're like, oh, my God, stop hitting her.
McGee, I guess, used parts of it for Charlie's Angels, too. Which I think is creepy.
Or like he just cuts away to scenes from Deadlier Than the Mail.
Well, I guess as inspiration to some degree, but still, it went through a, you know, modern transom. Now, you know, there's a movie coming out in just a couple of weeks, and we should mention it, and it's the director's cut of Payback.
No, it's out tonight. Is that today?
Is it out today? Okay, yeah. There you go. Did you get it?
Not yet, but that's only because I've been cranking on Iron Fist all day.
Okay, I'm of two minds. I hope it's good.
No, it is. It is.
It is really.
I have a friend. This is the thing: is this tape has been circulated amongst people for years. I've never had the good fortune to see it, but I have friends who have seen it. It's always this kind of friend of a friend. It's sort of like Prince's Black Album used to be, where like if you really, it's not. I mean, it's good. It's not great, but it's good. You know.
Okay.
Hegelin knows what he's doing and really made a great Parker movie. It doesn't. It's no Point Blank or anything. But,
there you go.
But check it out. Definitely check it out.
All right. That's fine. I mean, because, yeah, it is such a watered-down Point Blank. So, yeah, I guess I'll have to judge it on its own merits.
Reshot and stuff. Yeah, but no, I can't wait to pick it up. I've been waiting to see for quite a while. But it's one of those sort of legendary bootlegs that gets circulated time after time.
Oh, that's cool.
Deadlier Than the Mail is cool because Deadlier Than the Mail is sort of like the terminal point. After Deadlier Than the Mail, you're kind of in like from there on, it's like the girl from Rio, and like you've got like there's no more money to be spent on the super spy genre. You have to go to TV or really bad movies. Deadlier Than the Mail is kind of tough to get through. I mean, it's fun, but it's like it's really ugly. It's sort of all the ugly stuff. But it's sort of with a high budget, and like I said, it's Britt Eklund, and you know, and like wow. Huh.
Now, you mentioned Man from U.N.C.L.E. before, and then I want to ask is for other TV spy things. So
I've never seen Man from U.N.C.L.E. is the thing.
Get the hell out of here.
It's before my time. And like oh, I said, dude. I never, you know, and the whole thing, like it this is a great story about my dad. When my dad enlisted to go to Vietnam, they were like, well, do you want to come on Tuesday? And he was like, oh, you know, the third part of a three-part Man from U.N.C.L.E. is on Tuesday. Can I come next Tuesday? So they're like, yeah, sure. So, like, Man from U.N.C.L.E. kept my dad in the country a week longer before he went to Nam.
Jesus.
Like, I've always, like, how do you not want to see that show? You know what I mean? Like, I've wanted to see the show my entire life, and I've never been so lucky.
First season's great. It gets a little gimmicky in the last couple seasons, but the first couple seasons are really great.
Yeah, and I think my old man watches that, what's it, JAG? No, what's the Mark Harmon show?
Oh, NCSI.
Yeah, right, because what's his name is on it? Ilya.
Oh, that's right, I forgot, yeah. Ilya Kuryakin, who was played by David McCallum.
David McCallum is on it. That's, I think, the whole reason my dad watches that show, is because that guy's on there. So.
The Robert Vaughn is in a great current show. Do you watch Hustle?
I've seen, you know, I did it get better? I saw the first season and wasn't crazy about it.
No, I'd say it's still kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I like it. I like all those shows that come out of Kudos, the British production company.
Yeah, it's not that tongue-in-cheek didn't bother me. It's just sort of like, like dumb. I don't know. Like, and I really like Adrian Lester too as an actor. I think he's fantastic. I loved him in Primary Colors.
Oh yeah, hell yeah.
He was great. And there's the thing, you know, I had a, it was that role was between him and a friend of mine.
No way.
Yeah, and so I did not want to like him because as far as I was concerned, he took the part away from my buddy.
I can appreciate that.
But I thought he was great in that. So it's, the love scene to him at work and Vaughn is just fantastic. But yeah, I watched the 3 or 4 of the first season, and it was just one of those things that like TiVo kept collecting, and I wasn't watching, so I was like, I'll check him out though. You know, it's there's nothing on the baseball now. So
well, there exactly. Let's before we move on to Grindhouse, other spy TV shows from the 60s. What you know?
The biggest find for me came when I started doing casts. Was Department S and Jason King out of the UK.
Never seen it.
Invisible fans will recognize it immediately as Division X. It was this kind of proto-X-Files. Department S was a sort of proto-X-Files. It was a team of 3 secret agent types that were investigating the inexplainable.
Wow.
And it wasn't like a horror thing. It was sort of, you know, like the first episode is like a plane lands 24 hours after it was scheduled to, and no one can explain the loss of time.
A missing day. Wow, that's cool. What year was this?
It's going to be like 66, something like that.
Wow.
66, 67.
That sounds cool.
And then...
Prisoner, of course.
Yeah, of course. But then there was a spinoff show from Department S called Jason King, starring Peter Wingard, who is recognizable, again, to Invisible's readers as Mr. Six. I was a sort of dandy, but there's a whole like meta element where Jason King in Department S was a trash novelist. He was a pulp novelist, and the joke was that he was always turning their adventures into these successful airport novels. And he was kind of the most successful character on the show, so he spun off and had his own sort of dreadful TV show for a season. But they were great. Those are just spectacular, and I spent way too much money on like Region 8. A DVD box set from Australia or something absurd like that.
That's good to know. Yeah, believe me, I'm writing this down. I gotta do a search for these things.
Yeah, Department S and Jason King. And also, if you can find Peter Wingard's solo album while you're looking, you really, really should make the investment.
Now,
it has the greatest song about rape you could ever possibly imagine. By great, I mean terrifying.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's
wow.
Insane. I keep the album near me at all times to ward off demons and bad luck.
you're a fan of the Sweeney, aren't you? The 70s cop show.
I haven't seen it yet, but I've got
okay.
It, and I'm sort of I don't know what the hell my problem is.
Oh, you'll get to it. It's good. It's worth it.
This is what I hear. I can't wait to check it out.
Very cool.
Jack Les Camilla, Casanova superfan number one, turned me on to that.
Excellent. Greg Rucka and I were talking about it the other day, and that's why I bring it up.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to movies.
Okay.
And Grindhouse is out. We've both seen it.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on the film?
I think it was the best thing Rodriguez has ever done, which isn't saying much. And it was my favorite thing Tarantino's done in a long time, which is saying a lot.
Wow.
I thought Death Proof was fantastic. And I hope they split it into 2 movies, because I would love to go see Death Proof again, but I don't want to sit through... I don't think Planet Terror would hold up to a rewatch. I thought the trailers were brilliant.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I would have rather seen and hope they will make a full-length Machete.
Yeah.
Because that was really my favorite of the... I mean, I loved Don't, and I loved Thanksgiving.
Which I think is probably the best thing Eli Roth will ever do with Thanksgiving. Like, Eli Roth should be like, good night, everybody. That's it, man, because you've set the bar for yourself way high with Thanksgiving. Shit, the Rob Zombie thing was great. I want to see all of them.
Yeah.
The trailers were fantastic. Don't was brilliant. And Nicolas Cage is Fu Manchu. And they actually got Udo Kier to be in the trailer. It's brilliant stuff.
Yeah, no, that's the great thing about those guys is the way they use so many wonderful, like, you know, C and D list actors and stuff and really revive their careers and, you know, remind people how great they were, if they even were conscious of them before.
Peter Cushing needs to eat. That'd be a great movie title.
Well, I will say one thing about Planet Terror that creeped me out was how much Josh Brolin looked like Mike Norton.
And like Nick Nolte.
Well, and that's what I was going to say is if Norton and Nick Nolte had a baby, it would look like what Josh Brolin did in that movie.
No, I said to my friend, like, he's very much close. He's no longer in the Goonies phase of life, and entering the Pensacola Wings of Gold phase of Brolin.
Yeah, he was great.
I would love to see him and Nick Nolte together as a father and son.
You're right. It is. It's kind of a Jan Michael Vincent kind of devolution of a young pretty boy. It's like, yeah, you're not too young anymore.
And Michael Biehn is turning into Lance Henriksen. Like, I'm going to write a movie where, like, they're neighbors, where Lance Henriksen and Michael Biehn are father and son, and Nick Nolte and Josh Brolin are father and son. They all end up in the same apartment for a weekend.
Well, you know, it's a cheap cast, so you should be able to get everybody. Dude,
I know, right?
Write it up.
Like, what do you? Come on, I'll give them like subway fare. It'll work out.
All right, we'll be right over.
Yeah. All right.
You can even send a micro bus to pick them all up. You don't even need to like send them a real town car or a limo.
This killed me. Apparently, Peter Rose, the guy I used to work for on the Art Bomb website and write reviews for. Mm-hmm. Peter made these Art Bomb shirts. And he was the Brian Wood design, and he was selling them when he was in San Diego, and I wandered off to go do something stupid, I'm sure, and I came back, and Peter was like, dude, you missed it. Apparently Lance Henriksen has an Art Bomb shirt.
Oh, that's awesome.
And the Art Bomb tagline was, pull the pin, and Lance Henriksen's comment was apparently, pull the pin, that's awesome. You should make shirts that say, pull the trigger. And Peter was like, okay.
Mr. Henriksen.
I was like, we should shut the site down. That's it. We're done. We're never going to get better than that, right there.
That's outstanding. Have you seen any advanced screenings of Hot Fuzz?
No. I hear it's great, though.
I saw it, and it's very, very funny.
Excellent.
Very, very funny. And I'm thrilled. I had never seen Spaced.
I caught like an episode of it, and sort of didn't see the. Maybe I didn't wait. Maybe I wasn't patient enough. Should I go back?
Yeah, I liked it. I really liked it. Chris Crank turned me on to it from Devil's Due, and I've really been digging it. And it's. It's funny, I haven't gotten through all of them yet, but I like it enough, and I like Shaun of the Dead enough to really, give a shit. But it's amazing how great
Simon Pegg?
Simon Pegg. Yeah. He absolutely transitions into this character, and he's fantastic. And the other guy, the fat guy.
Yeah, the other guy, right.
The other guy.
The fat buddy. I'm sure that guy's really happy with that.
Exactly. Well, it's like what they used to say about Seinfeld, about the three tenors. It was, Placido Domingo, it was Pavarotti, and the other guy.
Yeah.
Jose, whatever his name was.
But he's great too. I liked Grindhouse. I thought the Tarantino thing was fantastic. I thought it was great. It was like Monty Hellman's Psycho. There's nothing there not to like. The Rodriguez thing just didn't really.
No, I like the Tarantino movie better as well. I thought it was fine. I'm glad I saw it. I don't know if I would necessarily want to buy him, and I don't know if I would necessarily want to see either of them again. I enjoyed the Tarantino part, and Planet Terror was fun, but.
Well, I think once the jokes are blown from Planet Terror, I don't think it's going to hold up.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, yeah, because
when all the surprises are gone, I don't think there's anything worth seeing. Well, like any John Carpenter movie, it's sort of.
Yeah, well, and I was even going to say there was that remake in the '80s of like one of the Corman movies from either the '50s or the '60s, and Karen Black was even in it. And I can't remember if it was, it came from Mars or whatever, or something from Mars.
Right, right.
But it really wasn't that far removed from Planet Terror. So, I mean, as much as it's, capturing everybody, or I guess not capturing everybody's fancy, I mean, it did okay. It had a decent opening weekend, but of course people have to remember it's a 3-hour-plus movie, so that's going to cut down showings and cut down box office.
Yeah, I think it's coming at the end of a zombie, it was a really weak zombie movie at the end of a really strong zombie cycle.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And it just, I didn't think it really captured, it felt sort of like an homage to, like, bad video horror of the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
And Tarantino, like I said, felt like he was doing Monty Hellman's Psycho. But it felt like the difference between film and video, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Once the wittiest stuff is blown for you, I don't think there's going to be any rewatch value in Planet Terror, whereas I could easily spend more time with those incredible women.
was it Jeff Fahey? Was he JT?
He wasn't that, wasn't he?
Wasn't that him as the barbecue dude?
Oh, son of a bitch! Yeah,
he's awesome, and I'm really glad to see him back. Speaking of the '80s,
oh my god, we reacted to his name in the credits, and I completely didn't even recognize him. Wow, I didn't realize that was Nicky Cadd as the guy, the zombie guy in the hospital, who was like, "Wait, you're gonna take your arm off? What, my arm? That was Nicky Cat."
What's he from?
He's like a character guy. He was on that show Boston Public. He was the hitman in the Limey.
Oh yeah, okay. No, exactly. You're talking.
He was in like Insomnia and stuff. He's a great. He's a really fantastic actor.
Very cool.
But yeah, I didn't even realize until I went through was reading the credits and I was like, oh my god.
The only thing that gets me with Tarantino films is, and especially like now you will know, wasn't the theme song of that movie from that Bo Bridges, Valley of the Giants or whatever?
No, I believe it was an all new piece of music that Jack Nitzsche wrote.
Okay.
I might be wrong about that, but I thought it was. I mean, since they made such a big deal out of crediting Jack Nitzsche, I figured it was. He was one of Phil Spector's like studio musician guys. He was part of the Wrecking Crew and that whole sort of L.A. rock scene of the 60s.
It could very well have been also used in that movie. But, yeah, I just remember it from this Ronnie Howard, Bo Bridges movie that I used to see on, Creature Feature every couple months.
Maybe so. I mean, a great soundtrack, definitely.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing about that I enjoy but also kind of drives me nuts about Tarantino. He'll pick really, really obscure songs. And that blows my mind. But like in Kill Bill, using the Ironside theme every time, Uma Thurman would have a flashback to realizing this is one of the people that fucked me over, I'd be like, well, yeah, of course it's a cool piece of music. I mean, or using the Green Hornet theme, driving around Tokyo and stuff. And it's like, yeah, dude, I mean, it's kind of the same argument I have with, some hip-hop music and everything, where it's like, well, yeah, no shit, you sampled the best fucking vibe that you could find from Stevie Nicks' Edge of 17. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
That's great. Gee, I wonder why it's a hit. But that's just me. There's my soapbox on it. Otherwise, I liked it.
Yeah, no, I was really surprised.
As we wrap up, I'll say thank you, and this is great. And
a delight, as always.
You know it, man. And I feel the same way. And for people who are listening, the only reason why I get laugh like this is because I'm always delighted when I talk to Matt. So thank you very much, Matt, and continued success on Iron Fist and Punisher War Journal. We're looking forward to the champions and the return of Casanova.
Thank you very much.
That's Matt Fraction. Make sure you check out his Marvel books and also Casanova from Image. But do yourself a favor. Go back and check out some of the older books that Matt has done, like Five Fists of Science from Image. Also a great book from AIT Planet Lair, Last of the Independents, and so many more. You can't go wrong with a Matt Fraction book. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% and more. That's right, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. Well, that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, you can catch Word Balloon at wordballoon.com, at our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon, comicspace.com/wordballoon, or you can subscribe to our iTunes feed, our feed at Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, all the various podcatcher sites, we're there. And if you enjoy the show, dig us at dig.com, D-I-G-G.com. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.